Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to MRSN, the Michigan Regional Sports Network.
It's time to enter the locker room, the coach's show of Michigan Admirals Minor League Football.
Everyone, welcome to the Locker Room and Blog Talk Radio and Michigan Regional Sports Network. I'm Donald Matthews, along with Lon Truck Turner. How you doing, Lon?
I'm good. How you doing, Coach?
I'm doing super. As well as Mr. General Manager himself, Mr. Bill Snornberg.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
What is so funny about that?
Nothing. I'm good. Got a lot to talk about tonight. We're scheduled to have a guest around 9:30. Author Kevin Toohey. He's also a motivational and inspirational life coach out of Medford, New Jersey. His previous book, The Miracle of Optimism, was number 2 on Amazon.com new releases list. But we'll be talking tonight when he calls in about his new book that is coming up in the next month, I believe. And it's called Competing with Compassion, Rediscovering the Lost Spirit of Sport. He got some important things to say, and I'm looking forward to him calling in and engaging in a little conversation and really talk about some of the things that are wrong with sport. He has a basketball background, so he's not one of those guys that really doesn't care much about sports and wants to tear everything down. He has a sports background, and I'm really interested to hear what he has to say. I don't know, Bill can't wait. But the World Series is... The World Series has started. For those of you that are mildly interested, the Tampa Bay Rays and the Philadelphia Phillies, and I believe the Phillies are hit 2-0 in the second inning, and I believe Bill is watching that in another area of the house. And Bill, you got anything you want to say about the World Series?
Tim McCarver's annoying. And it's good when your daddy's been a legend in broadcasting so you can get a job.
What's wrong with Joe Buck?
Nothing. I'm just saying. You should be glad that your daddy's a legend and you can get a job. It's who you know.
You make it sound like it's a bad thing. I think Joe Buck's all right as an announcer. I don't think much of Tim McCarver.
I didn't say he was bad. I'm just saying it's who you know or who you're related to. Not a bad thing.
Okay.
I would think that it's probably painful him to have to listen to Tim McCarver for anywhere from 4 to 7 games.
Yeah, I'm not a Tim McCarver fan. I never have been, and I'm sure that Manny Ramirez is not a Tim McCarver fan either. But that's neither here nor there, I don't guess. But let's talk football right now while we got a chance here. First of all, I want you guys' opinion on the Kellen Winslow thing. It seems like every year Kellen Winslow is into some crap and is begging to get out of Cleveland and whatnot. And the thing surrounding his hospitalization a couple of weeks ago, which turned out to be a staph infection, and I think this is his second bout with the staph infection, is something that's really that really seems to permeate on the Cleveland Browns team. Staph infections can be a serious thing, can be a very serious thing, and he's had it twice. And he spoke out afterwards, saying that the Browns aren't treating him right. We've heard the song and dance about the Browns not treating him right, but Do you think that Winslow should have been suspended?
Somewhere along the lines, don't you think, what happened with him? Because his dad seemed to have a pretty good sense about him. I don't know who his mama is, but his father seems to have, was a professional football player and knew how to act professional. What happened to his son? He goes one, his first mistake was going to the University of Miami claiming that he was a soldier, looking like a complete idiot, and then he gets to the Browns, and we established two things with the Browns, with his, so far with his professional career at the Browns. One, that he's an okay tight end when he plays. Two, he can't ride a motorcycle for a damn. And three, he can't wash his hands after he does his business. That's what we've established with Kellen Winslow.
Okay.
I think Bill just covered it all.
Yeah. I'm telling you. You know, and I've wondered that, too, over the last couple of days. Kellen Winslow was such an not only was he it's Kellen Winslow Sr. I'm talking about now, was such an outstanding football player. And not only that, he was the kind of guy, the kind of football player that you would want your kids that are coming up playing football to emulate. He gave his all to the team. He kept his mouth shut, and he was a team player. I don't know what happened in that gene pool, but Kellen Winslow Jr. got none of that.
I don't know if it's just because it just seems like it's a generation thing. It seems like a lot of the older players, you know, I mean, you had your few standouts who won some that ran their mouth or whatnot, but most of the older generation of players, they appreciated being able to play the game, where it seems like the newer generation kind of takes it for granted, like it's their God-given right to play football. And I don't know if that has something to do. I don't know why that happens, but it just, you know, it's like everybody should be, oh, well, you know, everybody should be happy that I'm playing football. Nobody cares. You could go, you know, go flip burgers somewhere. Nobody's going to care if you're not in the league next year.
The way I look at it is this way. You have two or three kids, okay, you know, and you have a genetic disposition to baldness. You have three kids. One of your kids is going to be bald. If you have a genetic disposition to being an asshole, and you got three kids that are assholes, the chances are that one of your kids are going to be an asshole. And he just happens to be an asshole.
So the other two Winslow kids are safe there?
Well, you know, I don't know. I'm just saying, you know, it's just genetically disposed in him. But unless Kellen Winslow is a completely different human being behind closed doors than what he showed when he played football and when he did some other things after football, I never saw that in him. You know, and I guess that's what makes it so surprising as a you know, to watch his son and the things that he do, because his father, he you never thought of him doing anything like that.
Sometimes I don't know if you could put it on the parents, because if you think about it, let's think of the two things, two families basically from the 80s. Look at Kellen Winslow, look at his kids, and then look at Walter Payton and look at Jared Payton. And Jared Payton went to Miami. And Jared Payton didn't turn out to be bad. Kellen Winslow's a punk ass. He ain't done diddly poo in the post. He may be leading that team in receptions, but when your quarterback's only completing like 10 or 11 passes a game and you have like 27, that don't say too much. And for him to boo-hoo about it not being treated right, if I was the Browns, I'd be like, well, you ain't done crap for us. You've been hurt and in the hospital and on injured reserve and not playing games, contributing that more than you have contributing on the field. And the only time he contributed is when they were playing well and winning games last year when they were making their run to the playoffs. And now all of a sudden they're not playing well and he ain't doing crap. I'd ship his ass to Oakland. I would ship his ass to Oakland in a heartbeat. Or Detroit.
Once again, every weekend we gotta threaten to ship somebody to football purgatory, which is either Oakland or Detroit. That'll straighten his ass up. Threaten to send him to Oakland. I don't know. You know, Oakland actually won a game this week. So maybe they're not. That's not the purgatory that we thought.
Or Kansas City. Send them there. They could have traded Gonzalez for Winslow. I think the Chiefs would have taken that trade.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they would have. They shopped Gonzalez around, and the Browns shopped Winslow around, and there wasn't good enough offers for either one of those guys. You know, I guess they said they're not going to give away the store, you know, just to get rid of somebody like that, you know. And as far as Gonzalez's situation goes, you know, I said on the show a couple of weeks ago, right before the trade deadline, that they really should, you know, for his sake and for all the years of service that he gave the Chiefs, and he did it without complaint. They should have did what they could to trade him to a team that would give him a shot, at the very least a shot at being in the playoffs. And the fact that they didn't do it, where's the Chiefs going?
Back to McDonald's to return those uniforms to Ronald McDonald.
So what's the harm? Reward the man for giving you all those years of service. He busted his tail for you. And the least you could have done is traded him to a contender, so he would know once in his life before he retired and wait on that call for the Hall of Fame that he played in some games that mattered, you know? I can't remember the last time he played in a game that really truly mattered.
That would have to be 4 or 5 years.
It's been a while. It may be longer than that. I really don't know. I really don't know.
I mean, he could always pull a Junior Seau and retire and just come back.
I really feel bad for Tony Gonzalez. He's unlike Kellen Winslow, he's been a guy that's did all that and has put up with a lot, especially the last couple of years with how bad the Chiefs are, and he's done it without any complaint. But as it is in sports, the squeaky wheel always gets the grease. And usually that squeaky wheel is the wheel that really doesn't deserve or warrant the attention because they're either jerks or they're just plain bad. But once again, that squeaky wheel gets the grease. And that's the one that you always hear about in the paper. You never hear about the guys that quietly go about their job week in and week out and do what they need to do because they are being paid handsomely to do that. And they do it without complaint. You don't hear about them. All you hear about is, when T.O. loses a game, T.O.'s going to cry and spout off and wonder why he isn't getting the ball more than the 20 times he's being thrown to and things like that. You know, the buttholes like that, you hear about them all the time. And I'm really frankly sick of the media giving so much attention to buttholes like that. Kellen Winslow, like Larry Johnson. Why does Larry Johnson feel that he could spit his drink in a woman's face and think because he's the running back for the Kansas City Chiefs, he can do that?
He's a dork, too.
It's just
no. He's this goes way beyond dorkdom.
Yeah.
This speaks to a disease, I think, that is just not only in football, in the National Football League, this is a disease that permeates through all professional sports, through college, and in a smaller scale, it permeates even through high school. This disease that, you know, because I am who I am, because I can tote the rock, because I can slam dunk and jump from the free throw line, because I can hit a home run 400 feet, because I can do those things, that makes me so damn special that I can get away with anything.
You're never going to get teams, because, you know, it basically would be collusion. You would never get teams to say, you know what, everyone get together. I'm sick of these jerks and what they're doing. So they're done. I'm releasing them and nobody signed them. You can't do that. And the best thing would be to do is to tell all these guys, okay, you know what, you're acting like a complete ass. You're done in this league. Go play in Canada. Go play in Italy. Because you're not playing the NFL no more. These guys are getting second, third, and fifth chances for no reason. They should. If you're suspended for four games, suspend them the rest of the year without pay. The problem is the Players Association would file a grievance and then they'd be back in 2 weeks.
You know, I agree with what you're saying there, but you know, about collusion and all that stuff. But, I mean, look, you know, when Roger Goodell makes a move, a unilateral move, and suspends somebody, he's calling Ayatollah. You know, and there has to be some kind of, then he goes back the other way, and he lets Pac-Man Jones back into the National Football League, knowing, I mean, it did not take a rocket scientist to know that Pac-Man Jones was going to screw up again.
It was just a matter of time.
And it wasn't going to take him long to do it. If you have the balls to say, look, you know, we do not need this type of element in the National Football League, and say that you are gone and you cannot come back, that would go a long way toward cleaning up what's going on in sports today.
I think the thing with a lot of the commissioners, the front office guys, they're torn because they, you know, you got the idiots that say, oh, well, you know, that whole boys will be boys mentality, you know, that he's just, you know, they're just out being, you know, they're young, they got a lot of money, they're just, you know, the fans that are like that, and then the fans that are like, we don't want this guy on our team. If they had more people that of that second group that got on these owners saying, look, you know, Kellen Winslow's an idiot, Pac-Man Jones is an idiot, we don't want him representing our city. We do not want Pac-Man Jones associated with our city at all. We don't care how many interceptions he gets, we don't care what. We don't want his name associated with us. And if they pressure these owners, then maybe the owners will do something. But as long as these people are going and sitting in the seats and paying all these, you know, tons of money for these tickets to go see these idiots, the owners aren't going to do anything. And the commissioner, he's at a point where, okay, I want the league to look good, but the league has to make money. What do I do? We need people at the grassroots, at the ground level, need to start complaining about these dumbass players that go out and just do stupid stuff. And I think if it starts there, it starts rolling there, that may be the only thing that'll change anything.
Yeah. The thing that I see, though, there's always going to be one owner that is either A, think that this person is going to be the last piece of the puzzle to a championship team, or B, is so desperate that they take a chance on somebody that has the questionable character. I mean, Adam Jones was of questionable character when he was in college. You knew what you was getting. Tennessee knew what they were getting when they drafted him. None of this should have been a surprise to them. But you know, but here we go. You know, you go and Dallas, you know, in my mind, Jerry Jones was just of that latter opinion. You know, Adam Jones is going to be the last piece of the puzzle that he thought to get Dallas over the hump to get into the Super Bowl. That Jerry Jones is so desperate to get to the Super Bowl that he will do anything, will spend any kind of money, bring in any kind of player that he think is going to get them over the hump.
That's the thing I don't understand about Dallas is the fact that they have they have talent across the board, both sides of the ball, but they just seem to implode every year. And
they have one of the worst coaches in the league.
But I don't understand why Jerry Jones would actually think that Pac-Man Jones is going to help anything. I mean, what do he think this, you know, giving him babysitters was going to change his opinion? I mean, was going to change his attitude? You know, Jerry Jones, like you just said, just desperate, really. Like I said, I said the same thing about the whole Roy Williams deal. I don't think Roy Williams is going to be that player to get them over the hump.
The Dallas Cowboys have the worst coach one of the worst coaches in the league. I mean, they do. He doesn't motivate anybody. He doesn't make any adjustments. Obviously, he lets the inmates run the asylum. I mean, he's never done nothing with anybody. You need, as much as they hate it, the only time they've really been successful was when Parcells there. You need a hard-nosed coach to coach a bunch of punk asses to keep them in line. Belichick's a hard ass. He's got a lot of punks. I mean, Belichick's a hard ass. He's got a lot of punks on his team. But do you ever hear, even when the Patriots were struggling those two games, did you hear Randy Moss mouthing off that he wasn't getting the ball? And before, Randy Moss would have been mouthing off.
That's the difference between two players.
Let's
face it, though. Jerry Jones doesn't want a strong personality to coach that team. He wants somebody that's going to kowtow to him and let him run up and down the sidelines and think he's the coach. I said this many times before about Jerry Jones. You know, he wants to be the coach of this football team. If you want to be the coach of this football team and not let your coaching staff coach your team, fire them all and name yourself coach. But he does not want that responsibility, and he doesn't want things to come down on his head like that when things go wrong.
Yeah, I mean, because
he's got somebody to blame now. He can point the finger at his coaching staff. He can point the finger at Wade Phillips. But if he was running the show, there's nobody to point the finger at. All the fingers are going to be pointing at him, and he don't want that.
Exactly. He's got to have that scapegoat. He's got to have somebody to say, well, yeah, he can't very well fire himself if he's coaching the team doesn't do well. So he keeps that scapegoat. I mean, same thing with with Al Davis.
It's a matter of perception. All right. You know, okay, yeah, he can't fire himself, but it's a matter of perception with people like Jerry Jones. Jerry Jones always wanted to be seen as the white knight that's gonna ride in and I'm gonna do whatever it takes to get this football team into the Super Bowl. He wants to be seen as the white knight that's going to swoop down and do those things. He does not, however, want to be perceived as the bad guy. He does not want to be perceived as the guy that you are what's wrong. And if he was in any other position other than being the owner / general manager / whatever else the heck he is, he should honestly, because he is the general manager of this football team, he should be getting a whole heck of a lot more criticism for the things that he does than what he does, than he does.
He's the one that
brought Terrell Owens in over everybody else's objection. He's the one that brought Pac-Man Jones to this football team over everybody else's objection, you know? enough said, you know? Yeah. We're going to let's bring in our guest, and we're going to speak with our special guest. Let me get him on the line here.
Hello.
Hello, Kevin.
Hello, how you doing?
Good, good. This is Donald Matthews from the Locker Room. Say hello also to Bill Schnornberg.
Hi, how you doing? How you doing today, Bill?
How's it going?
Also say hello to Lion Turner.
How you doing, Lion Turner?
Good. How you doing, sir?
Good. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on, Kevin. First of all, let's talk a little bit about your background and what led you up to becoming an author.
Okay, sure. Well, my first career in my adult life was as a collegiate basketball coach, and I made four stops in that arena at junior college level and the Division III level as an assistant, and then I was out in Iowa for 7 years as the head coach of Mercy College in Iowa, and I was also the athletic director there. And then I finished, it's funny, I just I've written much of the new book recently, but I just wrote the introduction yesterday, how I finished my career at Penn and how I ended up leaving at the peak of my career, actually, at the age of 38. So I was very fortunate to have 16 years in before the age of 38. And wasn't exactly turned right into an author. I got certified to be a life coach, and I do energy and psychophysiology work. And I work with a lot of athletic teams in the area of motivation, inspiration, energy management, Northeastern University, Temple University.
Okay. This is your second book that you got coming up pretty soon. Talk about your first book for a little bit, The Miracle of Optimism. Hello? We still there?
I'm here.
Kevin, you still there? Hello? Oh, I think I lost him. You're going to have to call back. Kevin, we lost you there. Call back, please. So we're going to wait a couple seconds for Kevin Toohey to call back and talk to him some more about his writing career, especially his new book. And he's bringing up some very good points in his book. Let's get him back on the line.
Sorry, guys, I seem to have a little technical difficulty there. Sorry.
That's quite all right. Talk a little bit about your first book, The Miracle of Optimism, which went to number 2 on the Amazon.com Hot New Releases list.
Yeah, I wanted to do a little it's actually a memoir with a purpose. I took 18 stories from my life. Some had to do with sports, but generally, I grew up in a very difficult home. I loved my dad, but he was an alcoholic, had trouble working, and we were, in poverty. So sports saved my life, gave me a chance at an education. And I have 9 brothers and sisters, and I have one sister who passed away, and she's central to the book. And it's kind of where I found my, how I found my inspiration and how I found my voice and how I stayed with it in spite of some difficult circumstances. And then there's lessons and exercises for the reader. So some of the comments that I've gotten since January of last year when I released it was, it kind of becomes the reader's book because they kind of can reflect on their own lives, even if they didn't have a life as extreme as mine. And I even warned of that in the introduction, that if you pay attention to the lessons and kind of work them, it could elevate your own life. And so I actually started writing Competing with Compassion first, put it down, and for some reason, and then started writing the other one, and now picked up, and it's even more appropriate now, I think, the new title than it was in 201 when I actually started writing it.
Yeah, let's talk about this new book, Competing with Compassion, the Rediscovering the Lost Spirit of Sport. I thought that was a great title.
Thank you very much. I think that what has happened over the last 20 years, and that's what's funny because that's when I got out of coaching, and I recently met with the center from our our 1987 University of Pennsylvania team that played North Carolina in the finals, and we were kind of talking a little bit about the wayward way that sports has gone. And competing with compassion really means I have a great deal of sport, care, a very deep passion for sport. And, you know, when something saves your life, and I really do think that playing sports did, it got me out of poverty, lifted me out of that. I got a master's degree. I went to college for free to play. And I have a lot of love for it. And I've seen it go from youth sports to the parents, to the overexposure, overcommitment, overcoaching, overintrusion of parental influence, right through to the pros. I met last week with Vaisika Hama, Freddie Barnett, and Brian Baldinger, all three former Eagles. And they were telling me about the lack of zip, the lack of love for each other, the lack of camaraderie in the pro locker rooms of today, the obsession with the coaches sleeping in their offices, overweight, unhealthy, lack of family life. I won't reveal the coach, but Brian Baldinger was telling me about, you know, one of the coaches saying, him mentioning, hey, your daughter's birthday coming up, but would you get her? Oh, I don't do that kind of thing. My secretary or my wife handles that kind of stuff. And I was an older dad. I didn't become a dad until I was 49 years old. I have an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old myself. I coach them in the youth leagues because I'm very concerned with, quite frankly, turning them over to somebody else, because we have too much emphasis on score. We have too much emphasis on not even winning anymore. It's come to, if you're not number one, you're nobody. I'm competitive as the next guy. I wanted my book to do very well. I'm glad I finished number two, but what we've lost, guys, is the lessons that are learned about life in the training process, in the journey of getting to those outcomes in the world of athletics today. And when I do leadership in high school and college levels, I don't have any pro contracts. It's all about getting back to this spirit of what competition means and the moment-to-moment attachment to the beauty of being a player and training. And putting fun back in it, and setting that goal to have great outcomes, but then leaving that goal out there and working your way towards it and having fun while you're working your way towards it. Paying attention to what perseverance can teach you, and paying attention. We're afraid to have our kids fail today. You know, we don't have anybody who knows how to manage disappointment. You know, I just finished a chapter where in New Jersey here, state of New Jersey, a woman who's on the Board of Education is actually suing the school system because her son got cut from the basketball team. You know, and I cited Michael, and he happens to be a sophomore. I cited Michael Jordan. I researched what Michael said that when he got cut from his sophomore team in high school, what that meant to him. I have two brothers who played college basketball for me, and one of them had a hard time getting in the starting lineup when he was in high school, and I've interviewed him around his perseverance. My own stories in the book about, you know, how it was that I worked my way into being a good player, and the value of getting there was equally as important, guys, as what ultimately happened, becoming an MVP and, you know, ultimately getting a basketball scholarship. So competing with compassion. You know, I don't propose in the book that we can go back to 1950 and 61 when I was growing up and played stickball and went onto the playground. But in the book, I actually renamed it. I got 7 methods to rediscovering the lost spirit of sport, because I thoroughly am convinced we could recapture the spirit of that era. No, we're not going to have playgrounds full of kids like, I don't know how old you guys are, but when we were playing, you played up to 10, you win by 2. That's not going to happen. We're not going to have stickball stadiums, if you will, like we used to. But I'll tell you what, one of the chapters I have says we have free-range chickens but no free-range kids. We don't have any free play today. Kids don't know how to split up teams. They don't know how to be the last kid picked and overcome that. They don't know how to make rules, you know, that adjust to the little area they have to squeeze a game into, or if 7 guys are there, how do you split that up? I had a recent practice with my soccer girls. They're 8 years old. I said, okay. I do this every time, but the first time I did it was amazing. I said, okay, last 20 minutes of practice. It's free play. I'm going to stand over here. Please don't ask me any questions. Please do not ask me to referee. Please do not ask me to get in the way. You guys do what you want. And the first time I did that, I timed it. They stood there for 13 minutes looking at each other because they don't know how to have free play. So that's the yeah, they stood there. And my daughter's on the team. You know? You know, I got to tell you, that's funny, but what's even funnier, what's been neat for me is I'm connecting back with guys. I met with a guy recently that the last time I saw him, well, I saw him in high school, but we played Little League baseball together. So it's been 40 years since I've seen Ronnie Shapiro. And I said, Ronnie, do you remember the time up at the field? And it was the field. That's what we called it. We thought we owned it. There's a house on it now, so I guess somebody else owned it. But I said, do you remember the time we were playing and there was a play at first base? And no, and of course, no referee, no umpire, and no one could concede that Bobby Lurie was safe or out, and we stood negotiating for a half hour, and he was laughing. So much was learned in that half hour. You know, people's opinions. You know, trying to solve the problem. Okay, do over. I think we ended up doing it over, but anyway, those things are being lost today.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I can remember. I'm old enough to remember that stuff, to be sure.
Good for you.
There's 3 points that I want to in your upcoming book that I wanted to bring up, but I wanted to let Bill and Lon ask a couple questions before I get to that. Bill, start out with you.
Well, do you think that the problem is that because I remember playing those games in the park and playing. I mean, we took old ping pong tables and made a green monster behind the house in our field for wiffle ball. So
that's pretty cool.
Bobby, so I mean, we played tape ball. My friend growing up still has the no hitter we have, the tape ball. He has it on a ball stand in his office. He still has it. So and he shares that too with people that you never see kids playing baseball, playing football in parks anymore. It's rare to see that. Do you think the problem though with the fun being taken out of the game is the seriousness of the parents before they even get to the coaches?
Yes, I think that the point I'm making in my book, it's the big circle. The kids are losing out, but eventually they pick up on all this, and then they have a sense of entitlement, and they have all this. But let's go to the parents and the coaches. Yes, well, you know, you put a kid in a uniform when he's 5, and then you put him on travel teams when they're 7. And it is very parentally driven. You know, they're afraid, people including me, afraid to let their kids go to parks, afraid to let them be alone. But they're, you know, there's too much organization and demand of practice too early in life. I interviewed this midget football coach, and I asked him, what's your biggest regret, blah, 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 what's the biggest struggle right now? He goes, well, they eliminated our 5-year-old program. I said, what do you mean they eliminated your – yeah, they didn't have the money this year. I said, why is that a problem? He said, well, by the time I get them when they're 7, you know, they already know their positions. Now I got to teach them that when they're 7. Well, you know, the kid that they stick at tackle, that got to play fullback or quarterback on the playground, never knows the freedom of sport. Even though they're going to be a tackle, say, when they get to high school, you know, they're in the playground, they get to be whoever they want to be. And, yeah, parents are suiting them up too early. They're in a uniform too early. There's too much structure early. And then there's this phobia, and I have it, you know, I did some research about, this is getting off topic a little, but not really, about, you know, kidnapping of kids and all this stuff. And it's really not that much more today than it was back when we were kids, except it's more publicized. But yeah, there's a huge ego element out there with parents. And since we have shows like I'm on with you guys right now, and I have my own radio show too, you know, there's an overexposure. Everybody's in a uniform too early. You know, I'll tell you a quick story. We had a reunion, and years ago, Tom's River here in New Jersey won the World Series, Little League World Series. And Todd Frazier, I played with his dad against him in high school and with him in college. And we went to a reunion, and our college coach, Jack Martin, asked Charlie. He looked at him and said, what's left for Todd? And Charlie goes, what do you mean? He goes, well, he's 11. He's been on ESPN. He's played in front of 10,000 people, and he's met the president. What's left for him to get excited about? And so, yes, that's a long answer, but I believe it's parent-driven. And so the kids go along at that age, and then before – my whole private practice is filled with 17-year-old kids who are burnt out because they're 11- and 12-year veterans of organized sports.
See, that right there, you know, you saying that kind of reminds me of Todd Marinovich that went through the whole thing where he was pushed and he ended up crashing and burning. But my question would be, what do you think is the problem with these pro athletes, you know, across the NFL, NBA, that consistently get in trouble, you know, the Pac-Man Jones, you know, what do you have a theory as to where that behavior may have come from?
Well, I think that, let's say, I think that what should be said is there are a whole lot of players that aren't doing that. There's a whole lot of players that don't get publicized, that are family men, who blah, blah, blah. But that being said, you know, we have a whole generation of great athletes that are, you know, I'll answer it this way. At Temple University now, Al Golden is rebuilding their football program. And I don't know if this is prejudiced, not prejudiced. And I don't mean racially. I mean demographically. He recruits 95% kids who have a mother and a father. And what he figures about that is that there's parental guidance at home in their formative years that he's not going to have, and he is a psychologist, he is a sports psychologist, he's not going to have to be, you know, a babysitter, and he still has discipline problems like anybody else. So I think what happens is there's not a support system. It's glossed over. The CHAMPS life skills programs in the NCAA colleges, you know, I know they're trying, but I got to tell you, they're cotton candy, because I've been in them. I've run my program in some universities, and they tell me it's too deep. They tell me the issues that I'm delving into is too much. So they, you know, they're teaching kids how to study, yes, how to write a check, blah, blah, blah. And then in the pros, Andy Reid's agent met with me once, and he's Bob Lamont, and he's also Holgren's agent, and he's a bunch of people's agent. And I showed him my program. I showed him my life skills program, and he said, Kev, this is too deep, meaning the questions were too hard, meaning too psychological. And so, yeah, if you get a bunch of kids growing up, and sports was their savior too, but they don't have a mom and dad, and they're growing up in rough neighborhoods, and you know, a lot of the NFL, a lot of the pro players are coming out of those single-family homes. And people are washing their hands. People are pushing them along and washing their hands of the responsibility that I think all universities have if you sign a kid, and pro team if you care about them as human beings, to provide the kind of help instead of just using them as a piece of meat. And then sometimes that's what it reminds me of. You know, I asked Brian Baldinger, I said, you know, does John Gruden and Andy Reid, and do these guys forget, you know, what it was like when they were kids, and will forget what sports is about? So I don't think the support system is there for those guys, and they're rich all of a sudden, you know.
Yeah, that's that plays into I think that plays a big part of it. You know, you got a guy that's scrapped for money all of his life, and all of a sudden he's filthy rich, and
that's right, that's,
most
that's
of
right.
these guys are just not equipped to handle that.
No, exactly right. You know, and the other thing I wanted to say to you guys about the spirit of sport, because I'm writing a whole chapter about this. I do a lot of work in industry, too. Like, I'll do work in hospitals around leadership and around enjoying life. And I'm going to be at the Borgata here. I say here because I'm actually on the beach writing this book. My wife pushed me out of the house, guys, for a week. That was just terrible to be on the beach here for a week in a condo writing. You know, it was a struggle, but you know, I had to sacrifice. I learned that in sports, you know, I sacrifice here. So, but anyway, the locker rooms and the whole mechanism of pro sports is now totally reflecting me going into, like yesterday, I gave a workshop in a hospital I'll be at the Borgata for three nights here coming up soon, Friday, Monday, and Tuesday. And here's what I'm getting at. 70% of American society, not me, but I'm in the 30%, hate going to work every day. They don't like what they do, and it's mundane, and they're bored, and they have no attachment to the spirit of it. That has drifted into pro sports. See, at the Borgata, it's the profit. You know, the bottom line is the outcome is the profit. And the pros, and now this is trickling down into colleges, even Division III, it's the outcome of the game. So it's the outcome of being number one, because it used to be winning. Now it's number one, because if you're not number one now, it's nothing. It used to be you had to win. Now it's number one. Well, those two things have become the same thing. In other words, it's all business. It's all corporate. It's corporate on the college level now. It's corporate and it reflects the general population of America. In all studies that I've read, it's about 70% of people polled do not like where they go every day. Imagine that. That's happened. That's happened in sports. And I have kids that I work with in high school that are now Division I players, and there was four this year I interviewed that I had them in high school, and now they're only sophomores in college. And the word they use is it's a business. And that's the same thing that's happened in pro ball. So it's just totally reflective. Imagine that. And, you know, I save these articles. You know, Brian Dawkins recently, you know, it all sucks until Sunday, you know. And boy, what a way to live. You know, if I had to live my life, that's what I mean about recapturing the spirit of sport. I remember as a kid reading comments like, I can't believe I get paid for this. And those guys weren't getting paid much. A lot of the guys when we grew up, you and I, were working part-time jobs in the offseason. And getting back to Bruce Lefkowitz, the center on the Penn team, one of the reasons, I know I kind of skipped over that story, one of the reasons it's become this is I asked Bruce, do you remember our weightlifting program? This is just 20 years ago. He looked at me, Coach, we didn't have one. I said, right. I said, Bruce, your junior year, the year we played in the NCAA against North Carolina, gave him a good time, by the way. When did you pick up a ball again? Because he said, Coach, it was always 3 months. Still calls me Coach. He's the vice president of Fox. He's making a million, and he's still calling me Coach. I mean, that says something about sports, too, but can't bring himself to call me by my first name. But we didn't have one. And if you when we watched the video together of the game, one of the things, J.R. Reed and Lebo and Smith, all those guys were slight in nature. Today, they're all football players because there is no postseason. There's no, it's a never-ending training. And so I kind of went off a little bit with your simple question, but
do you think the biggest problem maybe, I mean, it's a plus though, but the biggest thing is that once the salaries went into the millions and these guys were forced, now there's no off season for football. They're there at the facilities now year round. They're not gone for 6 months. Do you think once the salaries went so huge and went off the stratosphere where they were signed for 5 years at $50 million, they had to be there, that took a lot of the fun out of the game for a lot of these guys, where now they,
yep,
instead of saying it's fun, I'm playing football, now they know it's a year-round thing where they don't get any time off, and that takes the fun away from it because they don't get to recharge their batteries?
You got it. You know, it's funny because that's a vicious cycle. You know, you couldn't get any of them to give up any of that money, but it's become a vicious cycle. And the trickle-down has occurred. You know the highest paid employee in the state of New Jersey is Greg Schiano, the head football coach at Rutgers. There's
right.
something insane about that. And so now here's my point. The answer to your question is yes. And now he had someone on his staff tell me, I don't have permission to use the name, nor will I in the book, tell me. And then I started asking the question of other coaches. They told me they could do a third less of what they do daily, which what they do is they never see their families, they never see their wives, they're never home with their kids, rarely. Then that reflects down to the players because, see, they're being paid. I've heard coaches say, you're on a $40,000 scholarship a year. Do the math, kid. You better get in the weight room. So your theory is exactly right. It started up here at the big salaries, And now they're talking to college kids about their salary. Your salary is $40,000 a year. No debt when you get out, son. But I was also told, then I started asking the question, I don't have a coach yet has told me anything contrary. Yeah, we could cut out this. I don't know if you guys know this, but these high school kids, I mean, these college kids, I had a contract at Cornell University, Ivy League, non-scholarship. They watch, I'll tell you the story. I gave my speech. I'm getting ready to wrap it up. It's 10 p.m. at night. I said to the coaches, we're going to go out and get something to eat. No, it's 9 o'clock. Yes, but we got to be back. I said, back for what? Back for film study. I said, film study? You haven't played a game yet. No, practice. I said, what do you mean practice? Oh, yeah, we watch practice. We break it down, and then the kids have to watch it. I said, can I sit in on that? And so I sat in and watched these kids. They're all brain dead. It meant nothing to them. That's what I mean by a full third. Can you imagine when you were a kid playing, even in high school? I didn't want even when I was coaching. I'm a Hall of Fame coach. I mean, we did not win. We won in all the places I was at. And I turned a dead program in Iowa around. I hardly watched a game film. Johnny Wooden, who I used to get to talk to at the NCAAs all the time when I was coaching, never watched game film. These guys are now watching practice film. Why? Because they're being paid $40,000 a year to go there. So, yeah, you hit it right on the head. That's one of the huge reasons.
In the book that you're writing, you're going to make three main points. One we already talked about, parents. And also you talk about college recruiting and something that really caught my mind, the players' lack of self-responsibility.
Yes. Which one would you like me to comment on? Recruiting?
Well, do the players first.
Okay. Well, self-responsibility. I mean, first of all, I want to say this because I tell kids this all the time. I say, guys, you get criticized a lot, this era of athlete. Now, I always say to them that I admire you for the following reasons. I always say to them, let me tell you what you got first. First of all, you're the most committed group of athletes, and no one can dispute this. Time-wise and training-wise of any generation of athlete that ever played, so congratulations for that. And anybody that tells you any different, I will sit with them because I've been around this all my whole life and tell them that you're crazy, you know. And I'll tell you an example of that, and I will get to the responsibility. I'm sitting, I'm doing a program with a team. I got the coach in with me because many times a coach will come in with me. So he's bemoaning how hard it is to get his kids into lift weights and commit to the postseason program. And so he was surprised at my response. They didn't invite me back this year. So I don't know if this had something to do with it or not, but I turned to him. Here we are on the Jersey Shore here. I said, Coach, let me just ask you a question. In the spring of your senior year, a junior year in high school, what were you doing? He goes, well, I didn't play a spring sport. So did you have anything to do around football? He was the quarterback. No. Okay. So there was no 7-on-7, right? No 7-on-7. Okay. All right. So how about on June 20th? Where were you? I was down at the Jersey Shore. Okay. How about July 17th, Jersey Shore? I got them all the way down to Labor Day because that's when football practice started in 1968. I said, Coach, you are asking your kids. Your kids, if they play baseball, they still have to come and do 7-on-7. And then if they do baseball, they got to play summer baseball and then come to your camp. And practice starts in earnest in New Jersey on August 7th or August 8th, I said, so you know, it's a year-round thing. So what's happened with kids, it goes into the responsibility, so let me get to that. What's happened with kids is they have said, screw this, man. I'm giving up my whole life for this. And they have this, there's this entitlement then that comes with this of you know, if I'm given all this, then I'm entitled to be a starter. I'm entitled to I don't have to follow the rules. I don't have to be responsible. And then what happens with self-responsibility, when I went home, as crazy as my father was, he held my hand to the fire, and all the kids of my generation's parents weren't. My father was ahead of his time, I like to say. He criticized the coaches a lot. But generally in that era, you went home, and if you weren't doing your thing, man, you were getting an earful. it wasn't getting an earful around the coach. It wasn't the coach is this, the coach is that. It's get yourself in gear and get better. And kids aren't getting that. They're getting, well, the coach is responsible. You're not responsible. And so what I tell those kids is they're missing two things in their life. They're missing the close friendships that used to come with playing with sports, because we have individual trainers. The object is to get a scholarship. The object is for you to be better, but screw your teammates. And so they're being trained to not be responsible to the whole, to just worry about Johnny or Alice if it's a girl athlete, and to not have a contribution that goes beyond their own little place here, because they're going to go in for that $40,000 scholarship too. And then parents have this unrealistic explanation of how few kids actually get that. And so I think in general we haven't taught the life skill of self-responsibility in this generation. They're missing that. You know, we don't mind putting them in, like academically, we don't mind putting them in accelerated classes, you know, making sure they pass the state exam so that we keep getting funding. But we're not teaching how to be civil. We're not, and this is the spirit of sport, it's really the spirit of life. We're not teaching them to ask the question that I ask them to ask, is not what can you get out of this, but what can you contribute? You know, we're not asking them to ask that. It's when I get in and start training these kids, it's really foreign concepts to them. You know, there's a story in my first book about how excited Danny Benz was, who's still my best friend my freshman year, since he was so much better than me. When I first broke double figures as a freshman in high school, because I barely made the team, and how happy he was for me. This doesn't happen much today, you know. You know, when you get caught drinking, or when you break a team rule, and the rule is challenged rather than the fact that you have the rule and your son or daughter broke it and should be responsible for it. I mean, I know we're hammering on parents tonight, but you know, I think responsibility is taught, and we're not teaching it. And boy, I tell you what, I ask the coaches I work with, why would you ever want to do this for a living anymore? With what you're being held responsible for. I mean, I just did a program in Michigan. What's that?
You are definitely preaching to the choir. I'm telling you,
Well, good.
I can't agree with you more. I cannot agree with you more.
And are you guys located in Michigan? Are you guys located?
We are.
Okay, I have a contract in Michigan. I was out there this summer. I'm going out back in December with a high school outside of South Bend.
Nice area down there. Sun shines a little bit brighter down there than it does up around here.
Okay. Well, you know, it's good that I'm preaching to the – it's good that I'm on that end then. At least I can get down to Notre Dame and do that. But, you know, guys, I'm glad I'm preaching to the choir, because guess what? You know, it's neat meeting with those Eagles, because those guys said the same thing. This is why I'm excited. I do think, just like in the country, that we've hit a wall and we're getting ready for a big change. Just like when I go in and do teacher workshops, I see we've hit a wall in education and people are throwing up their hands. This is an exciting time to be doing this, because I think change. I think, and the kids are ready for change. You know, it's sad for me, guys, to go into a high school, the best running back in the state of New Jersey. See, he's really good, but he just signed a lacrosse scholarship, and he's so good in two sports. And I looked at he's going to be in the book too. I looked at him. I said, Chris, why do you look so exhausted? And he said, Coach, you know, it's a spiritual exhaustion. He's not physically. The guy's a stud. He goes, Coach, it's a never-ending season, especially if you play two sports. These two Olympic hopefuls, you know, they put off their whole life. One girl, I'm still coaching her on the phone. She's at the University of Alabama on full scholarship right now. She hasn't been in school since seventh grade, meaning that she was homeschooled so she could be in the gym every day for 9 hours. These girls don't get their periods until they're in their 20s because their bodies are so stunted. I just interviewed my first anorexic male, because of wrestling, cutting weight, didn't learn. It's so out of whack, just like the country, that it's exciting to be in this era. These three pros said to me, "It is. We're with you." Vaisika Hammond did not let his children play football till they were in eighth grade. Brian Baldinger said, "If you take a kid that like me, like him." He goes, "I didn't play till I was in eighth grade. By the middle of my freshman year, I caught up to every kid who had been playing midget football." So if you have the ability, you know, Joe Klecko played for the Jets. His son Danny plays for the Eagles presently. Joe played with my brother in college. He held Danny out till seventh and eighth grade. So we're starting to see, you know, what you guys feel and what I feel. And it's great to be on a show like this, guys, and I really appreciate the time with it because I do think we can make an impact.
Yeah, we definitely definitely love having you on tonight, Kevin. How close are you through with the book?
Well, I think that, you know, at this time, this suffering I'm doing here, listening to the ocean while I'm talking to you, you know, if I can get myself disciplined through this. Now, I'm thinking that realistically, I'm thinking maybe a summer reading next year, but I'd be more than happy to forward you guys a transcript early. Knowing me, though, I could get it out before then. I still got you guys?
Okay. Oh yeah, you still got me.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd be more than happy to look at the transcript because I think that's going to be some great reading. I'm going to let you get back to your work. I just wanted to thank you for coming on tonight and talking. And I hope the people that listen tonight can take heed with what you're saying and what you're going to be putting in your book.
May I just give out my website?
Sure, go ahead.
It's themiracleofoptimism.com. So and my email address is my name, kevintuohy@aol.com. And if you shoot me off an email, I'll shoot you back something unedited. It's real rough, but I'll send you to some stuff. But themiracleofoptimism.com is my whole website, and it shows what I do and where I've been and things of that nature. And you can order the book, The Miracle of Optimism, from the site there.
All right. We'll definitely be taking a look at that. Kevin Toohey, thank you for being a guest on the Locker Room tonight. Take care. And
okay.
So don't pay too much attention to those waves.
Okay. I had the door open because I know you guys aren't hearing them any out in Michigan. So I had the door open hoping you could catch a clip.
Well, you know what? It's 40 degrees here, so I could probably handle the waves a little bit.
All righty. Take care.
All right. Thanks, Kevin.
Bye-bye.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we'll talk some more football on the Locker Room on Blog Talk Radio and the Michigan Regional Sports Network. Stay with us.
Happy's Pizza, ribs, wings, and jumbo shrimp taste great. Happy to live as Happy's open late. Be happy, Happy's Pizza. Be happy, it's all good.
When you're hungry, real hungry for some yummy food, shout out to Happy, cause it's all good. Be happy.
Happy's Pizza has three Flint area locations, including their brand new location at Miller Road and I-75.
This is Jessica, boss lady of the Michigan Admirals, and you are listening to The Locker Room on Blog Talk Radio and the Admirals Radio Network.
No matter what's happening on the playing surface, no matter what the other team is doing, no matter what you think the officials are doing, sportsmanship matters. Sportsmanship defines us. It's one of those things that reveals our true character. Sportsmanship is what matters in educational athletics. For more information about sportsmanship, go to the web at MHSAA.com. A public service message from the Michigan High School Athletic Association.
Ladies and gentlemen,
protocol has been established.
Yes, it has. Protocol has been established.
It seems like that I have the red ass tonight.
Protocol has been established.
It seems like that I have the red ass tonight. Protocol has been established. Ladies and gentlemen, it seems like that I have the red ass tonight. Yes, I do.
Protocol has been established.
Yes, it has. Protocol has been established.
You know!
Welcome back to the Locker Room on Blog Talk Radio and the Admirals Radio Network, along with the Michigan Regional Sports Network. I'm Donald Matthews, along with Bill Schnornberg and Lon Turner. And, you know, Kevin Toohey brought up some great points. I could have talked to him all night.
Yeah, I might actually have to break down and read a book now.
Whoa, a lineman that could read, a novel idea.
Yeah, really. Tell them to knock off the lineman jokes.
It's all.
You know, we're happy that that Kevin Toohey took a few minutes of his time in his valuable schedule to talk to us tonight, and he's very passionate about what he's talking about, and that's one of the things you need, and he brings up some excellent points. I do want to hear that. I do want to read that transcript that he got. I'm definitely going to be hitting him up for that. Let's turn our attention in the last few minutes that we have here tonight to college football. We got some very, very big games coming up this weekend. Penn State, Ohio State, the backyard brawl down in Ann Arbor, Michigan State, Oklahoma State and Texas, Texas Tech and Kansas, which might be the best game of the weekend, and Georgia and LSU. Some phenomenal matchups. And I guess all eyes are going to be down on Columbus to see if the Nittany Lions are indeed for real.
I look for them to beat Ohio State. I think lack of experience in some of the, especially the quarterback position, I think that's going to be Ohio State's downfall. I think that's going to be the thing that is going to be their Achilles heel this week against Penn State.
I may be in the minority here, but Penn State has not impressed me much at all this year. They just have not. They beat an overrated Wisconsin football team. They beat a Michigan team and crushed that everyone knew that they were going to crush. They haven't beaten anybody this year. They haven't played. They've had, I think, out of their first seven games, six of them have been at home. I mean, they haven't faced any kind of adversity yet. And as much as Ohio State doesn't play anybody, at least they've played USC. They got smashed by them, but at least they've played someone. And they have, I think, more speed that Penn State has seen all season. And I just don't. I think Ohio State's going to win. Win Sunday, it's going to be like 20-10 or maybe even like 28-13. Penn State for some just does not impress me.
Penn State does have, history working against them. They have not won a game in Columbus since joining the Big Ten. And so that's been quite a few years. So that's going to be a tough matchup for Ohio State. It's going to be a close game. Michigan and Michigan State, it doesn't have the allure that it may have had in last years in view of Michigan's misfortunes this year. But really, even when Michigan State was not a very good football team, you could throw records out the window. When these two teams meet, it always seems to be a good game. And personally, I'm looking for, not just saying that because I'm a Michigan man, but I would not be surprised with a big upset this week.
It's like you just said, the records go out the window this game. This is a rivalry right here. It doesn't matter how bad.
I think it's. I think the thing with this game is that Michigan State's offense is tailor made for Michigan's defense. They're going to want to pound Javon Ringer. They don't want to put the ball in Hoyer's hand because first of all, he hasn't shown that he can handle that kind of stress, and second of all, he's hurt. So they're going to want to ride Javon Ringer in this ball game, and I think that plays right into the hands of Michigan's defense. If you run straight at Michigan's defense, Michigan's defense will stop you. It's off tackle and outside, and the vertical passing game they're having trouble with.
I was just going to say, I mean, like it or not, as much as everyone hates to hear this, Michigan is a bad football team. And their coaching staff is not coaching very smart. And if Michigan State does not get them this year, they will not beat Michigan for the next 10 years. And Rich Rodriguez has probably coached his worst year of football in his life because he looks like an idiot rotating quarterbacks, no matter if the kids three's hurt or not. His method of madness rotating quarterbacks is idiotic. And if D'Antonio does not shut them down and make them struggle and look inept Saturday, then they are in a – Michigan State will not beat Michigan for 10 years if they do not win Saturday. This is the best chance they're going to get to beat Michigan. And you better get Michigan while they're down.
Yeah, definitely. Because 2 years from now, that's not going to be that's going to be the least of their worries, you know. We also got Oklahoma State, and I don't know whether they're sneaking up on people, and all of a sudden you look up and go, wow, they're a top 10 team. But this is an outstanding football team. But they may be running into a buzzsaw this week playing number one ranked Texas.
Well, you got to think that somehow, some way, some defense has got to get Colt McCoy out of his rhythm. Take him out of his rhythm, take away a look, drop, do something, because right now the game is moving at about 33 RPMs on a record, 33. It is moving so slow for him right now, and nobody – yet this year has taken him out of a rhythm. You have got to either get to him, drop back and take away a look that he usually gets, or something, because anyone that's dropping 81% of his passes on people is in a zone, and you got to figure out a way to take him out of his rhythm.
And you actually bring up a very, very good point when you're talking about a quarterback at their best when the game slows down for them, when everything seems in slow motion, and it just seems like the whole field opens up to you. And even though you're thrown to a receiver that may not have a whole lot of room to catch the football, it just seems, because you're in such a rhythm, that you're thrown to wide open people, and you have so much confidence you can zip that ball in there. And, you know, and you make a great point that you have to do some things. You got to put some pressure on McCoy to take him out of his rhythm and speed the game up to him. Let me see. Georgia and LSU also coming up here, and that should also be a great game. You know, both Georgia and LSU have had moments where they look like the best team in the country, and they've had moments where they look like, what the hell, you know? It all depends on which team show up this weekend, you know?
Yeah, and it seems like that's been kind of the norm just this year, period. I mean, just with all the upsets that we've seen this year, it's like, sometimes it's like you're seeing two different teams from week to week. I mean, you know, the week to Florida got beat, and then they come back and, you know, and put up 45 points the next week against another one of the top-ranked teams. It's just, I don't know if it's something in the water that they're giving these kids on the sidelines or what, but it's just, it's weird.
I think the best, maybe the best game coming up this weekend is Texas Tech and Kansas. And I could probably say this with some degree of certainty. This is going to be a high-scoring game.
Texas well, I think Tech the only thing good serve for Texas Tech is if how healthy Crabtree is. And Mike Leach, I don't know what he's thinking. You have your best player, and he hurts his ankle, and you put him back on kickoff return? I mean, what? That's just stupid. I mean, that is just dumb. And, I mean, for them, I mean, it's the same thing. You got to take that quarterback, running that offense, the way he runs the spread and chucks that ball over the field, you got to get him out of his rhythm because he'll fire it all over the field. Leach will throw the ball 75 times if he wants to. He'll pull your favorite move, yeah, not do a running play the whole game.
I take that back. Oh, I think I've done that once, you know, in my early years of coaching, threw the ball every down. But, you know, other than that, I don't think I've ever gotten, thank you. I don't think I've ever gotten close to that. But I look for that to be a good game. But the next thing I want to bring up here before we get to our football pick 'em, the Heisman race. And, you know, it's time. We're just about halfway through the season, I guess, and it's time to start thinking about guys. And it's kind of nice to me that we can talk about Heisman Trophy. Your boy in Florida is not really part of the conversation.
But the thing is, people are still talking about him. Like if he has a big game, he could get into it, which is ludicrous.
I think that the Heisman race is McCoy's to lose. And by the way, we always talk about names, but anybody named Colt better be a football player.
or a sharpshooter or something.
You can't be somebody in the Wild West or something like that. You know, those days are gone. But if you know nowadays, if you're named Colt, you got to be a football player. If you're not, shame on you. But you know, like I said, it's between probably McCoy and Sam Bradford from Oklahoma. You know, until they lost a couple weeks ago, Bradford was playing every bit as well as McCoy was.
It seems like a lot of the times where you have a quarterback or an offensive player that does well, but their team isn't doing well, it seems like sometimes the Heisman voting is swayed by also how well the team does. You know, you can have a quarterback go out and throw for, 450 yards, 6 touchdowns, but, you know, the defense is terrible, and they lose. So should that be factored into the Heisman voting, or no? It seems like it is sometimes.
Yeah, it is. I think most of the time, it all depends on how well the team is doing, and I don't know whether that's fair or not, but it's part of the equation, and there's no denying that. But
It's obvious that it's McCoy's to lose right now. I mean, he's the games that he's had to show up on and play. I mean, he's had two big games, Oklahoma, and then last week against Missouri. And when you're completing 81% of your passes and you're playing at a school with that much tradition as Texas, and you're on primetime 2 weeks in a row, Texas is going to have to lose a couple games, and he's going to have to play bad for him not to get the Heisman.
Yeah. There's three guys that people probably should look out for. One is Pitt running back LeSean McCoy. He's been playing pretty well, kind of under the radar because Pittsburgh is not, a great football team. Iowa running back Sean Green, who's also had a good season, and Darryl Clark of Penn State, particularly if he beats Ohio State this week, I think he creeps into the Heisman discussion.
Well, I mean, really, I think, too, I mean, as much, even though they lost last week, if Rager has three or four more good games against, he's got to get up, if he averages about 200 yards the rest of the season, he still is a long shot to get it because he's won the ball. I mean, what kind of killed him last week was getting smoked by Ohio State. There's really only a couple guys. You could go to the wide receiver for Florida, still going to have a shot at McCoy, and Bradford's still in it. I think if Bradford could get Oklahoma to the Big 12 title game, he has a shot, still has a shot to win it. Texas loses a couple more times.
I never thought that Javon Ringer had any kind of a realistic shot of being involved in the Heisman discussion, you know, even with the kind of year he was having. Definitely the way that he was shut down and the way Michigan State was shut down by the penitentiary last week, that really does not resonate with voters for sure. And I think what little chance he had to be involved in this discussion went out the window last week. I doubt if he gets it back again. But, you know, also, you know, Noshawn Marino, he was hurt by who was that they got their tails kicked by?
Alabama,
right. And, you know, I think that really hurt him. But I think probably when you get down to brass tacks, that Noshawn Marino is probably the best football player in the country.
He's all right.
Oh, what? He's all right? You'll do? Hey, but before we get to, we got 7 minutes left in the show. Before we get to our pick'em for this week, I will be remiss to mention two things. Number one, congratulations to Mike Singletary being named the interim coach for the San Francisco 49ers. Sucks to be Mike Nolan, but you know we saw that one coming. We saw that in the crystal ball. He can hang up his tie for a little while now. And I have to say, how dumb do you have to be Matt Millen to get inside information from Brett Favre, and you still can't win a football game?
It proves one thing. One, no matter what information that he got, whatever Brett told him, one, he's too stupid enough to pass along to his coaches, and it worked so well that their team gave up 48 points. That is another reason why Matt Millen is on a farm in Pennsylvania right now needing hunting buddies, because he is a freaking moron.
the dumbest executive in sports. And, you know, and the Lions, despite the fact that they still have not won a football game yet, they are infinitely better off without Matt Millen. He should have been fired 2 or 3 years ago. God bless Matt Millen. Lastly, the NFL pick'em for this week. Let's take a look at our standings up to this point. Bill Stills leading the show with a 8-4 record. I'm coming up from the rear. I'm up to 6-6 now. I made it to 500, and Truck is at 5-7. I won last week with a 3-1 mark, and Bill and Truck were 2-2. There was only one person that was clairvoyant enough to see the Carolina Panthers beating New Orleans. But I will say the Truck was the only one that picked Baltimore to beat Miami. So,
thank you very much.
Yeah, but I will also say that you were the only one that was dumb enough to pick Denver over New England.
Yeah.
So that kind of negates things.
Yeah, they kind of balance each other out. They balance each other out.
Yeah, that can definitely cancel each other out. Let's take, I've got 4 minutes left. Let's take a quick stab at our four games this week. First of all, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers at the Dallas Cowboys.
Oh, wow. What's the status on Romo? Does anybody know? Because I've been kind of...
He's not playing.
Out to
November. I take Tampa. Because they got blew out by the Rams last week. Terribly blown out by the Rams.
I'm going to take Dallas.
I think Dallas is going to continue to struggle with Johnson at quarterback. Tampa Bay still got that good defense. I think Tampa Bay is going to pull off the mild upset and beat the Dallas Cowboys and really send T.O. over the edge. It's not fair. It's not fair. They only threw to me 25 times. It's not fair. Next game. The San Diego Chargers and the New Orleans Saints. This game is going to be played in London, England. So, you know, this is to me is a tough game to pick because both of these teams are, you know, going to be suffering from jet lag coming, you know, all the way across the pond to play a game in England. In New Orleans and San Diego are coming off losses, and both teams are struggling to find themselves offensively.
Yeah, I'm going to take the jet lag angle. I'm going to take the jet lag angle because, you know, New Orleans is – so I'm going to go with New Orleans because they got a shorter flight. That's my philosophy. That's my –
I'm going to take San Diego.
I think with New Orleans, with Reggie Bush out of the lineup, that's going to kind of hamper them offensively a little bit. This is a game that you're going to have to use your bench, for sure. And a lot of people are going to play, and I think that San Diego, particularly offensively, is a deeper football team. So I'm gonna pick the Chargers in this one. Next game, the New York Giants at Pittsburgh. This should be a good one.
Yeah, I love Bill.
I don't know the status of Polamalu.
I'm going to take the Steelers.
So will I.
You said at Pittsburgh.
Yeah, at Pittsburgh.
I got to go with my Steelers.
All right, clean sweep for the Steelers, and finally the Monday Night Football game. This is the toilet bowl, so to speak. This had I think when they made the schedule, they thought this was going to be a real marquee matchup: the Seattle Seahawks at the San Francisco 49ers. I'll go first on this one. I think new coach Mike Singletary with the 49ers, Mike Marks is making his offense isn't playing as well as it was the first couple games of the year. But Seattle does not have Hasselbeck, and even if they did, Hasselbeck has been having a horrible year. But Seneca Wallace is like, you know, he's like Brody Croyle's brother. if Brody Croyle had a illegitimate black brother, it would be Seneca Wallace.
It could be.
Yeah, it could happen. It could happen. I'm picking the Niners.
Yeah, I got to go Niners too because Seattle's just terrible this year.
Yeah, I'm going to take San Francisco. I think you'll probably see a different football team with the 49ers or Singletary in charge because that no one wants to look in that man's eyes when he gets pissed off.
No, you know, but I will say this, that I thought they were playing hard for Mike Nolan. I thought they were playing extremely hard for Mike Nolan. And I know some guys are kind of upset that Nolan was let go. The San Francisco 49ers, their organization is just not the same organization back in the Joe Montana days. When DeBartolo owned the team, you know, there was just a different mentality there. And now that, you know, that all that's gone and all those players are gone, it's just a different atmosphere at Candlestick Park now. It's really tough to figure out. I thought they should have left him alone. I didn't see the point in firing him. But that's just me. So we're going to recap this real quick with the Tampa Bay at Dallas. We got Truck and myself going with the Buccaneers and Bill going with the Cowboys. San Diego and New Orleans and London. Myself and Bill are taking the Chargers. Truck is taking the New Orleans Saints. The Giants at Pittsburgh. We're not giving any love to the defending champions. All three of us are picking the Steelers to win that game. And Seattle at San Francisco in the Toilet Bowl on Monday night. All three of us are picking the 49ers to give Mike Singletary his first victory as a professional football coach. We're going to get ready to – yes, sir.
What's the over-under for total quarterback sacks in that new Giants-Pittsburgh game? Because I see Eli –
Oh, I don't know. I have to get back with you on that, Trev.
That's
are you coming up to Atwood on Friday?
I think so, but I'm not sure. I'm not 100% yet. It's either there or I'm going to be up at Houston for the Southwestern game with my dad. So it's either or. I'll let you know.
All right. Speaking of Atwood, don't forget on the Michigan Regional Sports Network, we have a football doubleheader this weekend. Friday night we have the Battle for Flint, the City Series Championship with Flint Central and Flint Northern, the oldest rivalry in high school football in the state of Michigan. 6:45 is the pregame show, 7 o'clock kickoff, and then the following day, Saturday, we will be up in Saginaw for the Battle.